Here we are, everybody. We're on open air. David LaTulipe, your regular host, is not here this week, but I'm Leah Garchik, and I'm here filling in for him. So today we're going to talk about definitely holiday-themed music and performances. Our first guest is Daniel Hope, who's artistic partner of the New Century Chamber Orchestra, and he's going to talk about two concerts tomorrow and tonight and tomorrow night with Sophie Von Otter, Christmas concerts, and we'll be back with him in a moment. And then we're going to talk about the African American Shakespeare Company's production of Cinderella, which is on this weekend. And then we're going to talk about Kung Pao Kosher comedy series. So first, welcome Daniel Hope.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
And so tell us, have you been performing these? You are a concert master and music director of tonight's concerts. And have you done these before?
Well, I've been lucky enough to work with Anna Sophie Von Otter now for the last 15 years, and I'm thrilled that she's here in the Bay Area to play with us. It's the first time that New Century Chamber Orchestra is working with her, but we played last night in Palo Alto, and we have this beautiful Christmas program that goes from Baroque music through to White Christmas and other famous ballads, and it's just a huge joy to make music with her.
How great. When you're planning a Christmas concert, what is the newest piece in this concert? Is there Irving Berlin, is it?
That's probably the newest.
And the oldest?
The oldest is Corelli from 1630. So we span over 400 years of music.
So has Christmas music changed a lot in...
It has changed. I think the emotions are quite similar. You know, if you go back to Vivaldi and Bach and Handel, as we do in these concerts, you have different styles of music, and yet the feelings of Christmas, the feelings of comfort, tidings of joy, I think is still the same as it's always been.
So do you see that even in the most formal sounding to most non-schooled ears Christmas music, that there's a kind of warmth to it? That...
Absolutely. For example, we play the Christmas Concerto by Corelli, which, even though it was written in the 17th century, it still has that feeling of joy and of warmth, and puts you in a mood, I think, to celebrate the holidays, and that's what it's about, you know, making music to celebrate.
And everywhere that you have played Christmas concerts in other parts of the country, I see here that you are also music director of other parts of the world, rather, of the Zurich Chamber Orchestra and associate artistic director of the Savannah Music Festival. Is the appetite for this kind of music the same worldwide?
It is. And in fact, with Anna Sophie Von Otter, we've given concerts in Germany, in Switzerland, around the world, but also at Christmas time. And there is a real hunger for this kind of music at this time of year. And I think it's a great thing. It's a great way to come together, peaceful celebration of the holiday season. And to do so with 400 or 500 years of music is very special.
So you and Sophie Von Otter have played together for years.
We have. We started working.
She's singing and you playing.
Yes, yeah. We started about 15 years ago in all sorts of different projects. I mean, we've done even music from Theresienstadt, in fact, from the concentration camp. We had a huge project for many years where we toured and researched that music. This Christmas program is very different. You know, it's a lighter, really joyful celebration. And yet, to get to share the stage with a great, great singer like Anna Sophie Von Otter is a huge thrill and a privilege.
Uh-huh. And so as a musician, when you're playing and you're playing something that people know, I mean, they hear the first few measures of O Tannenbaum and they know it.
Yes.
Can you feel them sort of settling into the pleasure of that in a different way than they'd respond to a piece of music that they don't know?
Absolutely. And in this program, we also have from the Four Seasons of Vivaldi, we have the winter. So yeah. The minute that starts, yeah, or the second move, dee da da dee da da da, the second people hear that, they really relax into it, and there's a feeling in the church, oh, we know this piece, we love this piece, and they enjoy it. And you know, that's one of the reasons we make music, is to share it and to see that enjoyment.
Can you feel, I'm just curious about this, when you, I always think if there's one moment in a concert or a performance when you can feel the audience is just all at once, that they're all listening, that there's not a bit of rustling, that everybody, can you feel that from the stage?
You can, and you know, you hope for that moment in every concert. It's special when finally you connect to the audience. Sometimes it happens very early on. Sometimes it could take the whole show. Sometimes it doesn't even happen. And yet you are very much in tune with the music itself and with the emotions. And I think in Christmas concerts in particular, there is that expectation from the audience. You know, they want to enjoy it from the very first moment. And we have a really beautiful program, some of the most wonderful Baroque repertoire by Bach, by Handel. But then, of course, the Irving Berlin songs. There's also a traditional Swedish song that she sings, a Christmas song, which is beautiful. And the audience rose to their feet yesterday in Palo Alto. Even though it was a very slow song, they absolutely loved it. So we're looking also at the Christmas tradition around the world in this program and bringing you music from so many different cultures.
How wonderful. What Christmas music would you hum?
Would I hum?
Yeah.
Well, Jingle Bells for sure.
Have you ever played Jingle Bells
of
in a concert?
I have. In a concert? Yeah, I have. I have. But I mean, you know, if people would like to come along tonight or tomorrow night, and we're in San Francisco tonight, tomorrow night in Berkeley, and there are a couple of tickets left, I think, then they'll hear some of the great classics, and we can all, you know, hum together. And in fact, we do Tannenbaum or O Christmas Tree, and we get the audience to join us and sing along. So that's a lot of fun.
How do you show them the words?
Most of them know it, actually.
Yeah.
And Anna Sophie is out there, of course, you know, singing it very loud and very strong, and people kind of just latch onto that.
If you play something as the New Century Chamber Orchestra, not at this concert, I'm sure that you've played things that are more demanding and difficult for the audience to, can you feel when they're getting it and when they're not?
Absolutely. And, you know, part of it, I think also, I always talk during the concerts. I explain a little bit about the music and the pieces, even in the Christmas concerts, actually, because there are great stories about Corelli and Handel and Bach and Haydn and all these genius composers. So I do try and tell that story. And I think that also helps, particularly in a piece of music that's, say, not as well known.
So people know what to listen for.
Exactly, and I think it's it extends the experience of listening to music.
And when you're planning a holiday concert, how do you? What's in your mind? Is it a range of eras that the music is from, or a range of sounds, or a range of tempi, or what?
I would say it's a mixture. It's certainly a sort of the varying of emotions. You want to have the quiet, the soft, the joyous. You want to have the exuberant, you know, everything that we associate with our feelings of the holidays, whether it's children opening presents, or whether it's, you know, coming home and the snow is outside and it's comfortable and warm inside. There are so many associations that we all have with this time of the year. So it's really building on those emotions and, as far as I'm concerned, giving the audience a wide range of music so that it's not just about one style. And that's particularly great in these concerts with New Century Chamber Orchestra, is that you can really hear from very early Baroque music through traditional folk music to, you know, the 1940s and 50s with a great sort of almost Sinatra-like string sound accompanying a wonderful singer. So you have everything in this concert, and it's a great, great thrill to do it.
So do you think there are people who can bring equal amounts of love and affection for Bach and Irving Berlin?
Well, if you come along tonight, we can see. I think, yes, I think there are. I mean, I think the barriers between music, I've never really believed in, and I feel in these kind of concerts, they become so close. And I do think that Irving Berlin is a natural extension of some of the emotions you get in Bach and Handel and Corelli, especially Corelli. It's called the Christmas Concerto.
Yeah.
It's a Baroque or Renaissance Baroque depiction of what Christmas is. So time's moved on, but the feelings are the same, actually.
So let's just listen to a selection from Sophie Von Otter's
Christmas album. Yeah.
And this is the Christmas song, and then we'll get back for another question.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir of folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes on a glow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots and lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer.
I'm so glad that we listened to that in the middle of the segment, because you know when you say "and Sophie Von Otter mezzo-soprano," it implies a certain crispness that's wonderful, but that's not the warm and fuzziness that you hear from this. This gives Mel Torme a run for his money.
Completely,
he, of course, was
completely
famous for this. So is it a special thrill to make people feel warm and fuzzy?
It is, but it's a special thrill to listen to Anna Sophie von Otter as well, because, as you say, she's known as this huge opera star. She's dominated the stage for, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, and here she is. She will be singing Vivaldi. She is singing some Bach in the first part, but then she sings Mel Torme, and she sings, you know, White Christmas. And to see that transformation and to hear it is something that is very unique. And I have to say it, it's just amazing to be next to her on the stage and to see her do that, listen to her, but also see how the audience react to it.
Right.
It's wonderful.
So to wrap up again, this will be the holiday concert of a New Century Chamber Orchestra. We've been talking to Daniel Hope, and the concert is going to feature Anne Sophie von Otter, the Swedish mezzo soprano.
Metro's good.
Only performs in cities. And she'll be singing tonight at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in San Francisco, and tomorrow night in Berkeley at the First Congregational Church, where she is spreading that warm, wonderful sound. So we thank you very much, and there are still a few tickets available.
A couple, yes. But please come along. We'd love to see you.
Okay.
Dich zehren mit zärtlichen Trieben, den schönsten, den liebsten Mann meine zu sehen. Bereite dich zehren mit zärtlichen Trieben, den schönsten, den liebsten Mann meine zu sehen. Den liebsten, den schönsten, bereite dich zehren. Zärtlichen Trieben, bereite dich Zion mit zärtlichen Trieben, den schönsten, den liebsten Ort bei dir zu sehen.
Our next guests are here today to talk about the African American Shakespeare Company of production of Cinderella, which has been, this is its 19th year, is that correct?
It's like the 18th or 19th. I lost track a while ago.
So that voice was that of Sherry Young, who was the founder of the company.
Yes.
And director of this production.
Yes.
And we're also here with Fumi Lolo, who is Cinderella.
Yes, Fumi Lolo.
And has a wonderful polka dot headband around her, and she looks so bright and cheery.
Thank you.
Like Cinderella. I should look under the table and see if you're wearing your glass slippers. So tell me first, Sherry, about the production, which is, let's see, it's December 20th to the 22nd at Herbst Theater, and on the 21st there's a tea. Right?
Yes, we have a Cinderella tea happening at 1 to 3 o'clock, and it's kind of in the middle of two shows that are bookmarked for that date. The show's been around for 18 years, and I started Cinderella because at the time there were no images of positive black females for kids. And we did it before Brandy and Whitney Houston did their version, mm-hmm. and it's our signature show. And year after year, the kids keep coming. And I was telling Fumi that a couple of years ago, a young woman came to me and she said, "Oh, I've been watching your Cinderella since I was a little girl."
How has it changed over the years?
Well, each director has their own spin on it. We're always having a different cast. I don't think we've ever had the same Cinderella once. It's always a different Cinderella. And for me as a director, the cast indicates to me what's new about it. And Fumi is a really wonderful actress. You know, a lot of people think that Cinderella is all about Disney and the heroine waiting for this prince or man. And that's not our version. Fumi is like well-rounded, and she has a wonderful speech at the end that talks about where her strength comes from and how she found love, and it's all within herself. So,
Fumi, it sounds like your journey, I read a little bit about it, and I hope you can talk about it, from where you were born to where you are now, is one where you've taken action, where you have moved to change things in your life and make them better. So can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I was born in Nigeria, and then we moved to Jamaica when I was 5. And then when I was 15, instead of dropping us off at school, my dad kept going until we got to the U.S. Embassy. And then in a little office, it told us, "Oh, okay, so why do you want to move to America?" And I was like, "Oh, we're moving to America?" So then we moved to America when I was 15, to Arkansas. Yeah, and then we spent the next 10 years in Arkansas. I went to the University of Arkansas. Then after graduation, I worked a couple years, and then I was like, I want to see what else is out there. So I moved to Boston for a year. It was too cold. Then the company I was with at the time had a project in San Jose, and I was like, I'll take it. Winter's coming. And then I did a year in San Jose, and then I moved to San Francisco, and I've been there ever since.
So is your family back east?
They're in Arkansas.
Oh, they're still in Arkansas. In Fayetteville.
Yeah, they're actually in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, which is a little bit of a ways from Little Rock, which is the capital. Not a lot of people know that.
And how does it feel to be Cinderella?
Oh, my goodness.
Cinderella is probably the biggest kids' role model, biggest kids' figure in all of fairy tales.
Yeah. So, like modern day fairy tales, Cinderella is the second, from the Disney perspective. Snow White was first, Cinderella second. So, the story of Cinderella is like embedded in our culture these days. And the fact that I get to be Cinderella, when growing up, I remember watching like parades of princesses on like Thanksgiving, Macy's parades and, you know, Disney parades, and being like, oh my God, one day when I wake up, when I grow up, I want to be a princess. And then immediately being like, oh no, I can't be a princess. None of the princesses look like me. I'm too dark skinned, my hair and all of this stuff. And at 8 years old, being so sad about that, and then couple decades later, here I am. I get to be Cinderella. I get to fulfill this like childhood dream.
Do you mean to say that some things are actually changing for the better?
Yeah.
In this world?
Sometimes dreams really do come true.
You, Sherry, you are directing this production?
Yes, I am.
Have you seen changes in the variety of directors that you've had for all those years?
We've had some wonderful directors. Each director has a different skill set. Some directors are more choreographers, and you'll see more dance numbers and routine. Some directors are more writers, so they'll add in new scripts or scenes, you know. So over the years, I've seen some wonderful, and sometimes I try to add all the things I liked about the other shows, but each production is its own unique version. And, you know, this is a wonderful, wonderful cast and a wonderful production. So much fun, so much liveliness. And we have the best adult actors, and our young kids who are in the show. They came to challenge the adult actors. They were off book on first day of rehearsal. Uh-huh. They're tentative. They're wonderful young actors.
Over the years, have you seen a difference between the way male directors? I assume there have been male directors,
there has,
too.
Yes. I mean, our artistic director, yeah. L. Peter Callender,
yeah.
He's directed a few times. Yes. Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that when a male directs Cinderella, they're really coming from an admiration of just the story themselves. Because Cinderella is not a female story. It's about heroes and heroines, people overcoming challenges. And everyone could see that about themselves. Mm-hmm. And so Cinderella, you know, people think it's just for girls. No, the young men in the audience laugh just as hard as the little kids and little girls. It's for everyone.
Well, that's great. Let's take a break now and listen to a piece of music from it. This is, it is called Almost Pretty, which is certainly not true for the Cinderella who's sitting here.
Oh, thank you.
This is the singer and composer is Angel Eaglin. So let's hear a little bit of Almost Pretty.
Living happily with my Prince Charming. And even if it's make-believe, I can be happy. Daddy, if you were here, you'd take me in your arms and say to me, I'll always be your pretty girl. That you were near me. When I danced with you, there was no danger, no fears. But now I sit alone, wondering if I'll ever find a home to call my own. No rules will keep me from living my dreams.
So, in it, what this song reminds me of, I mean, it's a pretty song. When I see Disney versions of things like Cinderella's, I always notice that the hands are like this. They're fluttering. I bet you don't do that. You fool me.
Well, I don't flutter. But there's a certain grace, I think, that should come with the character. So, and I think that's part of what they're trying to portray. Like, the grace that is inside is externally being shown through the fluttering hands.
That's interesting. So, and you work on that by yourself, or you have a coach that...
Flutter
directors.
Hands? Not the
flutter,
but
no,
the, like,
not
the
flutter hands, but a kind
yes,
of...
Yes, the arm movements. Yes.
You can't see this because we are on the radio. But Fumi stood up, sat straighter in her seat, and moved her elbows out and kind of reared back with her hands. So she looked like she might be serving tea to Queen Elizabeth. Or having tea with Queen Elizabeth, because
I'll take either one.
Cinderella is absolutely an equal, which leads me to, I mean, in this age of Me Too, mm-hmm. is about sexual harassment, but it's also about being bullied by people mm-hmm. who are stronger than mm-hmm. you. So do you think this, why don't you each take a moment to answer this, that Cinderella is a Me Too girl because she stands up for herself?
You know, I think that Cinderella finds that she had strength all along. She's in this household with we call them the step family, doesn't treat her right. But she has such a genuine heart that what happens, she's not taking it internally. It's not making her bitter or hard. She's hopeful that each new day, something new or something different is going to happen. And that's very unusual because mm-hmm. a lot of people that get into those kind of real life situations, it starts breaking them down. Mm. And I think that's what's unusual about Cinderella. You know, I have a sister that reminds me of Cinderella.
Oh, wow.
Every bad thing that happens, she's like, oh, that's all right. It's going to turn out fine. Mm-hmm. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I agree. Cinderella's superpower, unlike the other princesses that, you know, people are so much aware of, is that she has not allowed the negative circumstances, the mean words, the ugliness around her to infiltrate her heart and color it and make it bitter and angry. And that's an incredible, incredible trait. I have tried and sometimes failed to, because it's
me
hard.
Too.
Yeah,
me too.
You're human. Yeah. But so, she reminds you to just be strong and hold on to what you believe and hold on to the purity of your heart.
So reading about some of your background, I read that you've been a CPA consultant.
Yes.
So you are a CPA?
I am a CPA.
So can you have... Do you think there'll be use of those lessons learned from Cinderella in your career as a CPA?
You know what? I actually do think so, because sometimes when you go into these client situations, they're not always happy that you're there because for whatever reason, maybe it's government mandated or, you know, someone's messed up and you have to come and fix it. So people can be defensive. And so it's up to you to just come in with a smile and just take whatever they say to you and just kind of let it go, smile, go out the door and kind of just let out some steam.
How about the other way around? Are there lessons from being a CPA that you could apply to Cinderella?
Wow. You know what? Before I became a CPA and started working in public accounting mm-hmm. and consulting, I didn't really consider myself to be a hard worker. I just thought I was just, you know, normal. But it really taught me the meaning of hard work, late night. You just do whatever it takes. And with Cinderella, that's what I'm trying to do. You got to do what it takes. You have a show. Yes, you have work. Yes, you have other things. But do what it takes to succeed and do well.
Yeah. So they are,
yeah.
although they mm-hmm. seem incompatible, they are.
CPA
so
Cinderella.
Just a minute more. How about the glass slippers? Do you have to make different ones for all the Cinderella?
It's funny that
you
asked that. We have like 6 or 7 variations of a glass slipper. None of them fit Fumi. We had to get another one, and I think it barely fits. I don't know if Fumi's
going to...
I don't think Fumi's going to be in these shoes for a long time.
You're going to be Cinderella with blisters on her feet.
Right.
But a smile on her
you
face.
Can't, you can't put a pair of sweat socks in
no.
them.
No.
So. Okay, well, we've been talking to Sherry Young, who is the director of the African American Shakespeare Company's production of Cinderella, also founder of the company, mm-hmm. and Fumi Lolo, who is Cinderella. The production plays December 20th to the 22nd at Herbst, and on the 21st, between there are two shows a day,
right.
And on the 21st, between the two shows, there's a tea.
There's a tea party.
So thank you very much for being
thank
here. It was
thank
fun
you for
to
having
talk
us.
With you.
It was.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Put on your yarmulke. Here comes Hanukkah. So much fun to celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the festival of lights. Instead of one day of presents, we have 8 crazy nights. When you feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree, a list of people who are Jewish. Just like you and me. David Lee Roth lights the menorah. So do James Conkirk Douglas and the late Dinah Shore. Guess who eats together at the Carnegie Deli? Bowser from Shanana and Arthur Fonzarelli. Paul Newman's half Jewish, Goldie Hawn's half too. Put them together, what a fine looking Jew. You don't need deck the halls or Jingle Bell Rock, 'cause you can spin a dreidel with Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, both Jewish. Put on your yarmulke, it's time for Hanukkah. The owner of the Seattle Supersonicas celebrates Hanukkah. O.J. Simpson, not a Jew.
Okay, I couldn't resist letting that go on for a while because it's funny.
It is.
So welcome to Lisa Geduldig, who is a founder of Kung Pao Kosher Comedy, which is performing December 24th, 25th, and 26th at the New Asia Restaurant. There's a 5 p.m. dinner show and an 8:30 cocktail show. So Lisa's here with Mark Mayer, who is a comedian from Britain.
Correct.
Right, from London?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
How did Lisa find you, Mark Mayer?
You tell the story.
Okay, and correct me if I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
Thank you. I heard about Kung Pao Kosher Comedy, and I have performed many years in the UK, and just thought it would be a perfect match to come and do my kind of Jewish observational humor over here. And we got in touch, and I sent some clips of what I did. Lisa seemed to like them, which was a good sign. And that was pretty much it. That was the match was made.
The match, it was shidduch.
The shidduch, of course.
was made. And Lisa, Mark is the third foreigner. Did I read that? Foreigner is such a terrible, the third person from abroad. Foreigner sounds like an alien.
My wife calls me a lot worse. Trust me.
Yeah, actually, we've had two Canadians. And
that doesn't count,
right? Just North American comedians, and he's the first one from across the pond.
Is the tradition of Chinese food in a movie on Christmas Day? Is that true in Great Britain too?
Yeah, I think the food definitely.
Chinese food.
Yes.
Or
I would say
it
so.
Hasn't.
Just any
I mean,
food. Well, Jewish people and food. Just if there's food there, they'll eat it. It doesn't Chinese, Mexican, Italian. Just as food. There's just 24. That Jewish
but
people.
But
yeah.
In England, Indian food is kind of to English daily life what Chinese food is to.
Probably, yeah,
American.
Yeah.
American. But there's no tradition of eating Indian food on Christmas. In England?
Not as far as I know, no. I mean, most families, it's funny, when I was growing up, most of my non-Jewish friends would feel incredibly sorry for me. You know, you don't celebrate it. And what do you do? And we eat. That's what we do.
but you don't have the tradition in England of Jews going to a Chinese restaurant on Christmas.
Not specifically like that. No. I wouldn't say that was set in stone, no.
Okay, so we won't be doing Kung Pao Kosher Comedy in London next year.
The London version. Maybe Paris.
London's Chinatown.
About expanding your...
Yes, I've thought about doing it all over the country, all over the world. There have actually been some other people who have created similar events since Kung Pao Kosher Comedy, which was started in 1993. I started it thinking it was just going to last 1 year. It actually came out of going to a Chinese restaurant in Massachusetts. I went to perform at a comedy club. I didn't realize it was going to be a Chinese restaurant until I got there, called the Peking Garden Club.
and I was telling Jewish jokes at a Chinese restaurant. So the idea for Kung Pao Kosher comedy, Jewish comedy on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant, came out of the fact that I was accidentally telling Jewish jokes at a Chinese restaurant in Massachusetts.
So at this performance, I mean, some of them, will you be telling Jewish jokes, Mark?
Well, my style is kind of observational humor. So things that I think resonate with Jewish people all over the world. It's not a specific. So I've been doing a bunch of shows here in kind of preparation, warm up gigs for the big shows at Kung Pao. So I'm finding a lot of, you know, observations resonate. The main subjects are things like food, family, parental guilt they bestow upon you, which is a pleasurable thing. Arguing. There are stereotypes, I guess, and cliches that, you know, are universal. And as I've been doing stand-up like 27 years, so in London, you're always going to be playing to an international audience. And
So are there jokes that work with certain groups of people? I mean, in an international way and geographically?
Not really. I mean, I've traveled all over the world, so I've done, funny, you know, you talk about Chinese food, I've done shows in Hong Kong and I've done shows in Japan. And so
that'll be much more. Joke about Chinese food in Hong Kong.
No, they don't really get it there. They just so, hey, you guys, your food, yes, what about it? it depends wherever, you know, wherever I am, I'll cater for the particular tastes, comedic tastes.
But it's really amazing how universal humor can be. You know, like I was just telling Mark, we have like the same guilt and different dumplings, you know, in different cultures. You know, it's just like I can be talking about the Jewish mother archetype on stage, and then someone comes up to me afterwards who's Chinese or Catholic or whatever and says, oh, I have the same mother.
Yeah. Well, I always think that a joke is based on, you're leading the listener in one direction and then a surprise at the end.
Yeah.
Take him in another direction. If he could follow you, then he feels good because he's made that leap, or she.
Yeah.
And also observances of common experience that maybe you haven't noticed that happens.
Yeah.
And the comedian will point that out. It's like, oh, yeah, I've noticed that, but it just hasn't really rung a bell.
So there's some, for instance, and it was great coming over here because we use your GPS, what you'd call GPS, we call SatNav, which is satellite navigation. Now, had I not had this conversation with Lisa on the way over here, I would have probably said SatNav in the show to have 300 Jews going, what? What's he? So the joke is I have a Jewish GPS. It's like a normal GPS, but it's two people arguing. So I'm in the car and I hit in 30 yards, turn right. What do you mean turn right? You can't turn right. How many times have I told you we can turn right? Turn right, I can't turn right. You've reached your destination. Shekoyach. You know, so there's that. And I think people get it because arguing is not universal to the UK.
So are you going to tell some Brexit jokes?
No, there's no comedy in that. I might mention Prince Andrew.
Ah, that's really interesting because I until a few months ago wrote a column and I decided at some point that there was no comedy in Trump jokes.
Yeah, it's
either.
The same sort of. It feels like it's been done. It's, you know, the news itself is the humor. I don't know, and every angle has kind of been explored and developed. I think. I mean, so I'm not. I kind of steer away from the politics. Because invariably you will get somebody going, hold on a minute.
A Prince Andrew jokes, huh?
Yeah.
Do you think the royal family is about as far away from a Jewish family as you could imagine?
Yes, I do. And I have the Queen here. I'm absolutely appalled at my son's behavior. And
although it was Jeffrey Epstein who got him into trouble.
Yes, yeah. Thank goodness he's not around to speak for himself. Well, there's Jeffrey Epstein.
Do you have Jeffrey Epstein jokes?
Well, no, but I did think that, you've got Jeffrey Epstein and Harvey Weinstein. I wondered if there was a bit of a theme going. All I'm saying is I think Bruce Springsteen's looking pretty nervous right now.
Thank God for Charlie Rose. all those priests, actually. They're the ones
let's redress
the Jewish people from that terrible reputation.
Exactly. Thank God they're redressing the balance. Yes, bring them out in their droves.
Lisa, how do you go about looking for Jewish comedians?
I Google Jewish comedians. I ask other people who have performed if they have anyone to recommend. People like Mark contact me and send me a clip.
And then money.
That way.
money and donations and bribes. And no, it was purely on my talent, wasn't it, Lisa?
Yeah, I was telling Mark before we came in here that I had a 14-year-old comedian about 5 years ago from New York, because I saw that one of the comedians who had performed at Kung Pao had posted on his Facebook page that he was mentoring this 14-year-old comedian. And I said, send me a clip. And I thought he was really funny. So I booked him, and his parents came out to the show. One year I was Googling for Chinese Jewish comedians. I thought, I need to find somebody, and I couldn't find a Chinese Jewish comic, but I found a Korean Jewish comic who was married to a Jewish guy, and then she converted and she was teaching Hebrew, and I thought, all right, good enough.
It's quite a niche market.
I should have mentioned that the headliner for this show is Jackie Hoffman. So did the comedians talk with each other before about, so that they don't overlap, or maybe they do want to overlap?
Nobody discusses their material until you get on stage, and then maybe you'll go, oh, I guess I won't be telling that joke because they told it. But everyone from my 26 years experience so far doesn't have any of the same jokes. Everyone has different perspectives. Like, you know, even though everyone's a comedian or a Jewish comedian, everyone seems to be bringing a different perspective to the stage.
They're not all kvetching about the same thing.
No, we're kvetching about different things. And then Nathan Habib, who is one of the performers, this is his second time performing. He came to the show as an audience member at 14 and came up to me with his mother after the show saying he just started doing comedy. And I said, oh, that's cute. Keep in touch. And then we kept in touch. And then when he was 21, he did the show. And that was 9 years ago. And now he's 30 and lives in New York and is still doing comedy.
Wow.
And I'm excited about Jackie Hoffman. There are certain people I've tried to get for 10 years, and I finally got Jackie Hoffman.
Will you describe a little bit who she is?
Yeah, she's actually a comic actress and also does a lot of shtick with music, but she'll be doing just stand-up. Right now she's playing Yenta the Matchmaker in the Yiddish production of Fiddler on the Roof in New York. She's most known for her role of Mamacita in Feud, Betty and Joan. And she's been in Adam's Family on Broadway, and she's very, very funny.
Did I see her? I looked at her face, and I thought I saw her in a documentary about plastic surgery.
Yes, because someone just sent it to me the other day, and I watched the trailer,
really,
and she's
interesting.
all over the trailer.
Yeah, she's all over it,
Yeah. And then, so a few different people I've tried to get for years and finally did. David Brenner, Elaine Boozler.
Yeah. So, Mark, in the tryouts, in the material you've been working on most recently, that's been here?
Yeah. In Throckmorton Theatre. And then Punchline, a little bit closer to here. And then I've got a couple of other shows happening. So,
do you find, those of us who sort of like jokes and comedy, see that the British sense of humor is revered, kind of like, you know, British crumpets or something, that it seems to be, from the outside at least, drier. Do you find
I suppose a little bit more sarcastic. I think, yeah, a bit more self-deprecating. We revel in self-deprecation. You know, making fun of ourselves—that's our shtick, I suppose.
That's British, that's Jewish, too. Exactly.
Yeah. So, I do more myself. I do more self-deprecating humor. It's just I'm not very good at it, so. I'm hilarious 24/7. I really am. I'm one of the funniest male British Jewish comedians doing the Kung Pao comedy this year. You won't find a funnier male British. And I'm not playing anywhere else, Lisa. Nowhere else. Only Kung Pao kosher comedy. And there are still tickets, aren't there?
Yes,
there are.
In spite of...
And so to round up about the tickets...
You want to say goodbye to me now?
No, about the ticket situation.
I'm on a roll. More bagel with locks.
Viali. Okay, so Kung Pao Kosher Comedy is December 24th, 25th, and 26th. There for each night, it's at the New Asia Restaurant. It's a 5 p.m. dinner show and an 8:30 cocktail show. The 24th and 25th dinner shows are sold out. But I should also mention that there are some charitable beneficiaries, the Kahila Community Synagogue Immigration Committee. Is that correct?
Correct.
And groceries for seniors.
Yes.
For a Jewish thing, that's
really, and also just basic needs. I like to give away money and awareness to a couple of organizations each year. Ever since the first year, I've been doing this. Tzedakah is the concept of charity, and I like to. I feel like it's a social responsibility to.
The little blue boxes. Did you know?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you really took your time with them, you could get most of the money out.
But it makes a lot of noise. Everybody would know it.
Well, normally there's elderly people, they can't hear. That's a noise. That's hearing aid. You know, so. But I have my own charity. I mean, I'm not. These are wonderful charities. My own personal charity is the Mark Mayer Hanukkah Fund.
I've got three kids.
Well, I hope these performances add to that.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. And the website is www.koshercomedy.com. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you
don't
you
have to
much.
Be Jewish. Just have a sense of humor.
Okay.
Is my land, so give the tropical down to the tropical seashore. By then, yum, 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 yum. Sesame Mikhail. Take an old shoebox, pack it up with lunch, because on the beach the bunch likes to munch. You won't have to season the carrots and peas. There's garlic and cheese in the ocean breeze in Coney Island.
In Coney Island.
It's so continental in Coney Island.
In Coney Island.
Yes, that's my land. So take the family, Molly and Sammy, swimming in vain. Yum, 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 yum. Sesame Mikhail.
And before Peter Robinson begins, we just want to say that it's Edith Piaf's birthday. So wherever she is, we wish her a happy birthday with no regrets. And now we're going to hear from Peter Robinson, who is a regular on Open Air. He's a critic at large, and he's going to talk about what's on the festive holiday season menu.
Hi, Leah. Good to be here. And as Edith Piaf would say, je me rien, I have no regrets. And as we go into 2020, I'm giving some thoughts about different events happening around the Bay Area. And I'm going to start off with the Marin Philosophical Society. And I say that with a yes. Yes, they do have a Marin Philosophical Society. At Marin, you always ask people, how do they feel? And they'll certainly tell you. At the Marin Philosophical Society, they'll tell you how they think. So the Philosophical Society meets in San Rafael, and they use the word philosophy in the widest sense. So it's really thinking about thinking. They meet on the third Thursday of each month. There's a guest speaker, and then lunch, and a fairly vibrant open discussion about matters to do with philosophy. So let me give you a couple of examples of some of the topics that are going to be coming up in 2020 at the Marin Philosophical Society. The first is Dr. Michael Kavner. He's going to be talking about the theory behind a just war. Is there such a thing as a just war? And when I look into what's happening today in Afghanistan and we talk about coming home, bringing people home, there's many questions to do with freedom, with security, with morality, with fairness. And Dr. Kavner will be covering all this type of subject, and then it'll finish over lunch with a lively discussion. As we move into the year, other happenings at the Marin Philosophical Society include the philosophy behind Frank Lloyd Wright and how did the design of the Civic Center in San Rafael, how did that come about? What is the thinking and how does that fit into a sense of community? And to show you how broad some of the subjects are, The British author Tony Broadbent, who has written a couple of books about the Beatles, will be looking at the philosophy behind the Beatles, about their music, their business ethics, in fact, the lyrics, the songs they put together. What is the thinking there? And then later in the year, we're looking at the nature of the moral ambiguity in film noir. So there's a lot of interesting subjects coming up. They have their own website at marinephilosophicalsociety.com, and you can find out all the events there. The lunch is $30. It includes a speaker, and it meets at the McGuinness Country and Golf Club on Smith Ranch Road. So that is something totally different, a new way of lunching and thinking all at the same time. Now, the other event, which is going to run through the first 3 months at the Literary Society, covers how to start your memoir. And if the beginning of the year is a good time to reflect on the past, to catch up on what you have done in all the earlier parts of your life, and how at the same time to stay in the present. So there's going to be some guidelines on writing a memoir, times of self-reflection, times to interview family members and friends. And I often suggest bringing some memorabilia, old photographs, jewellery, rings, if you're in the military, medals, which can in many ways be memory prompters, and sometimes music too. And to find out more about that, I'll give out a phone number. It's area code 415-381-6671, 415-381-6671 at the Literary Society, and the memoir writing course starting in January. Now, this time of year, I always select a book that's been of importance to me, and a book which, in this case, is part memory and certainly truth, at the same time, sadness. It's called Say Nothing, the author Patrick Radden Keefe. It's a true story of murder and memory in Northern Ireland. And in my case, I remember covering the border country in South Armagh, which we always used to refer to as bandit country. And this, I think, has turned up on every major book list for 2019. But I say it's a sad book. It begins with the kidnapping, where a mother of 10 is taken from her house, children are left behind, and it's very much, in this case, a Belfast story. The lady in question, Jean McGonaville, is part of what they call a mixed marriage. One partner is Catholic, the other partner is Protestant, and it's the actual neighbours who are involved. And I use the word she disappears, but as they would say it, she is disappeared. She goes missing, and suddenly you're back in Belfast in the 1980s. It's the city of checkpoints, of barriers, no-go areas. It's also the city of petrol bombs. And some of the names that I remember, which were so much part of the tapestry of that period, Gerry Adams, Bobby Sands, and of course in power in the UK is Margaret Thatcher. And this is the time known as Bloody Sunday, and of course, at the heart of it, Ian Paisley. So this is just a very powerful piece of writing, a powerful piece of history. He is a gripping storyteller, and he takes you straight into that spirit of place. It's an accurate history and shines a light on Northern Ireland during dark times. Highly recommended. Book title, Say Nothing. And finally, to round out things, I've got a couple of thoughts about if you're making New Year resolutions. And I always say, in one ear and out the other. They last no more than a few seconds. How do you retain them? Well, to find the answer to that question, January the 4th, at the Book Passage at the Ferry Building, there is a workshop given by an expert in this field who, in what she really wants to do is get you to make lists, because until you write it down, you have no idea what that resolution really means and how long it's going to last. Her name, Paula Rizzo, and the actual book is called The Listless Life. And if you start allocating time, so you take your New Year's resolution, you put it on a piece of paper, and then you start working out how much time you want to spend actually putting it into action. You set up a schedule, and if you have a friend, you try to make yourself accountable. In other words, are you doing what you set out to do? For people who are already keeping journals, you know, this may be an added version to how your journal becomes a guideline. So those are just some of the thoughts for upcoming years, 2020. The Marin Philosophical Society, lively lunches, engaging speakers. The Literary Society, get started on your memoir. A book which will take you into history, a history of Northern Ireland, Say Nothing. And here we go, New Year's resolutions, not revolutions, with Paula Rizzo at Book Passage at the Ferry Building on January the 4th.
Thank you, Peter. Just to underline your points of reference, the Marin Philosophical Society, you can find more information at www.marinphilosophicalsociety.com. And the memoir writing workshops from the Literary Society, you can get more information at 415-381-6671. Now,
thank you, Leah.
Thank you. Sure. Let's talk about next show. We're going to be taking a holiday break, and the show will be back on the air with David on January 9th. And at that show, he'll be talking with about the 11th Annual Fresh Festival of Experimental Dance, Music, and Performance, which is from January 6th to the 26th at the Joe Good Annex. He's going to be talking about the Berklee Community Music Chorus and Orchestra's concerts from January 10th to the 12th in Berklee, and clarinetist and composer Matt Ingalls about the 2020 San Francisco Tape Music Festival, which is devoted to the performance of audio works projected in a three-dimensional space. Okay, that is Open Air for this week. I've been your host, sitting in for David Latulippe, whose wing is mending. This is a reminder that all of our shows are archived at klw.org. Search for Open Air or a guest name. And if you have a guest suggestion, send an email to david@klw.org. I'm sure he would love hearing from you. I thank producer Neil Swinkles and Jean Marie, board operator. I thank you for listening. I hope the lights on your Christmas tree twinkle and your latkes are crisp. Merry and happy to you.